The wise man tells us that of the making of many books there is no end, and certainly there is no end in sight for the making of books and articles and presentations on the subject of divorce and remarriage. The New Testament treats the issue of divorce explicitly in five places: Matthew 5:31-32, and 19:3-12, Mark 10:2-12, Luke 16:18, and 1 Corinthians 7. Interpretations of these New Testament logia are available from many different perspectives and generate many different views, some more rigid, denying all divorce, some more permissive, allowing or at least tolerating divorce in almost any circumstances. The paper that I'm presenting now undertakes to show that the reading of these passages from the New Testament, especially those in the Synoptic Gospels, intertextually with the Mishnaic tractate Gittin, which deals exclusively with the legalities of the certificate of divorce, renders the more permissive interpretation of the New Testament teachings on this issue highly dubious. I assume, of course, that the Synoptic passages are genuine reports of the sayings of Jesus, and I assume the authenticity and Pauline authorship of 1 Corinthians. I will also assume that the tractate Gittin, even though it was written several decades after the Gospels and after the first epistle to the Corinthians, reflects Jewish traditional views which were current during the earthly ministry of Jesus. I want to begin with a cursory consideration of the more common interpretations of the various New Testament sayings on divorce. And I simplify a great deal here, both in exegesis and theology, to group these interpretations into two broad categories, which I will take the risk of calling the more rigid or less permissive, and the less rigid or more permissive. And I'm going to characterize them as follows. There are some students of the Scriptures, especially those who prefer a less permissive view on divorce, who have interpreted these passages, beginning with the Gospels of Luke and Mark, to forbid all divorce and any subsequent remarriage. They read, "Everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, and he who marries a woman divorced from her husband commits adultery." That's Luke 16:18. And the second passage, "And again he said to them, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her, and if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery." That's Mark 10, verses 11 and 12. This passage, which forbids all divorce, may be modified slightly by the exception in the Gospel of Matthew, or by the so-called Pauline privilege in 1 Corinthians, to allow for the active divorce of an adulterous spouse by the innocent spouse, or the passive divorce of a Christian spouse by a non-believer. And I read those two passages. "I say to you that if everyone who divorces his wife, except on grounds of unchastity, makes her an adulteress, whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery," Matthew 5:32. And "but if the unbelieving partner desires to separate, let it be so. In such a case, the brother or sister is not bound, for God has called us to peace," 1 Corinthians 7:5. And frequently these have been interpreted to say divorce on grounds of unchastity or adultery is permissible, and the innocent party may remarry, or the situation of a Christian divorced by a non-Christian spouse is such that the non-Christian is allowed to remarry. Various people have offered that interpretation as well. Those who favor a less stringent standard for the permissibility of divorce and remarriage than seems to be implied by the first reading of these various passages have suggested the differences between these passages imply a traditional development away from rigor and toward a more permissive policy. And those who prefer this less rigid view usually argue for the originality of the Markan version. They say Mark's version was the first, forbids all divorce. But then they say it was a hyperbolic statement, it was an exaggeration, or it was an ideal which we can't always realize. And then they see the exception in Matthew and the Pauline privilege in 1 Corinthians as rational, spirit-guided developments on the church's teaching in divorce, which were produced within the infant Christian community in the early decades of its development as a response to the social realities of life in this world, which, as we know, does not always mirror the ideals of paradise. In parallel with these two patterns of biblical interpretation, there are two lines of pragmatic reasoning which support these views. The former, more rigid view is held by people who say that it is faithful to the precise reading of the text and also closer to the divine ideal revealed in the stories of Eden in Genesis 2. In their understanding, the duty of believers, both individuals and the church, is to uphold and promote this ideal by guiding those who are in marital crises to live up to their high calling in Christ Jesus and by shielding the church from the destructive influence of those who persist in disobedience. Those who adopt the second, more permissive view perceive it as more compassionate, more representative of the loving and forgiving spirit of Christ. In their understanding, the duty of believers in the church is to encourage and support those who are passing through the tragedy of divorce. It is our duty to avoid judgmentalism and condemnation and to ensure that vulnerable parties, such as children, are shielded from all avoidable harm. From this perspective, the more rigid interpretation of the New Testament passages is harsh and legalistic. Rather than seeking to limit the harm of divorce, it seeks to punish, to censure, to restrict those who are already suffering a great personal tragedy. Now, each of those views has its defenders and its defense, but today I want to ask which of them, if either, most closely represents not only the letter, but the spirit of the New Testament teachings on divorce. And in order to do this, I want to consider the social setting of these New Testament statements and the thought world in which they arose. This was the world of rabbinic Judaism. Now, it may be argued that Christianity detached itself at a very early date from Judaism and its theology, and even that Jesus rejected some of the traditions and customs of the Jewish nation. But in fact, Jesus' entire ministry took place in the context of those interpretations and customs. And even Paul's statements in 1 Corinthians, though they were directed to a community surrounded by pagans and to a group largely made up of recently converted pagans, still reflect the concerns of the Jewish community, which were subsequently, a few decades later, recorded and codified in the documents that we now call the Mishnah. There have been a lot of studies, both popular and scholarly, of the New Testament passages dealing with divorce and remarriage. Not all of them have looked very carefully at Jewish views on divorce and remarriage. However, since there are two of these statements from the Scriptures, the two from Matthew 19 and Mark 10, which arise explicitly in a discussion between Jesus and certain unnamed Pharisees, we frequently find reference to the Jewish teaching on divorce, as though there were simply one Jewish teaching. Now, this can be as brief as Ellen White's statement in Thoughts from the Mount of Blessing that, and I'm quoting here, among the Jews a man was permitted to put away his wife for the most trivial offenses, and the woman was then at liberty to marry again. This practice led to great wretchedness and sin. Or sometimes we'll make reference to the fact that there were two schools of thought in the Jewish community, the group that we call the School of Hillel and the School of Shammai, or Beth Hillel and Beth Shammai, named after the rabbis who were their leaders. These two groups differed on the criteria for divorce. The former were more lenient, the latter more strict. And in this view, the Hillelites allowed divorce for any reason, and the Shammaites allowed divorce only for adultery. This, in fact, is based on a passage at the end of Tractate Gittin in the Mishnah. The school of Shammai say, a man may not divorce his wife unless he has found in her aught improper, as it is said, because he hath found some unseemly thing in her. But the school of Hillel say, even if she spoiled a dish for him, as it is said, because he hath found some unseemly thing in her. Rabbi Akiba says, even if he found another more beautiful than she is, as it is said, and it cometh to pass that she find no favor in his eyes. So, there are the two views. In fact, however, that passage reflects not the totality of the rabbinic discussion on divorce, but only their debate on the exegesis of one verse, Deuteronomy 24, verse 1, which they've cited there. The Hillelites were prepared to allow divorce on any grounds on the basis of this passage. They said that the unseemly thing spoken of in Deuteronomy 24:1 could be anything that the husband didn't like. The Shammaites argued that the expression used there in Hebrew, it's ervath davar, uses one word, ervath, which is used in other places to refer to either nakedness or, more specifically, to the genital region. And so they said this had to have something to do with sexuality. Ervath davar is a matter of sexual impropriety, and so they only authorize divorce on the grounds of sexual impropriety. Now, that doesn't mean that the rabbis of the house of Shammai denied divorce on any other grounds. It only meant that they didn't believe you could justify divorce on any other grounds from that passage. Deuteronomy 24:1, in their view, only justified divorce on the grounds of sexual immorality. More recently, there is a scholar named David Instone Brewer who has pointed out that the conventional description of the possessions of Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai is not accurate, because actually both schools of rabbis acknowledge that at least one other passage in the Torah authorized divorce. This is Exodus 21, and in fact Exodus 21 deals with the status of a female slave who is taken as a wife, but they said that it applies to free women as well. Exodus 21 verses 7 through 11 says, "When a man sells his daughter as a slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. If she does not please her master, who has designated her for himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has dealt faithlessly with her. If he designates her for his son, he shall deal with her as a daughter. If he takes another wife to himself, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, or her marital rights. And if he does not do these three things for her, she shall go out for nothing without payment of money." The principle in this passage that a woman deprived of food, clothing, or sexual relations had the right to leave without incurring a penalty was employed in the Mishnah to authorize divorce. This is actually in a different tractate. It's in Ketuvot. It says, "If one put his wife under a vow to have no connubial intercourse, the school of Shammai say for 2 weeks, the school of Hillel say for 1 week only." But the commentators agree, by saying that, they were saying that at the end of that period, if the husband didn't either annul his vow and return to the marriage bed, he had to divorce his wife and let her go because he was depriving her of her rights. So both the Hillelites and Shammaites allowed divorce on grounds other than adultery. These grounds included denial of conjugal relations and denial of food and clothing. Now, of course, Instone Brewer, the scholar I've just cited, goes on to say that since Jesus didn't disagree with that passage, that means that Christians can do the same and we can divorce on those grounds as well. And I wouldn't agree with him on that point for several reasons. But the point I want to make is that we can, at this point, characterize the positions of these two groups of Pharisees. Both groups held that Exodus 21 allowed divorce on the basis of the deprivation of the marital rights of food, clothing, and sexual relations. The school of Shammai added the provision for divorce on grounds of sexual impropriety, based on Deuteronomy 24, verse 1, but that was irrelevant for the Hillelites because they interpreted Deuteronomy 24, verse 1 to allow divorce on any grounds, so they didn't have to worry anymore about Exodus 21. And since their position became normative for the whole Jewish community, the discussion about Exodus 21 became moot. However, and here I come more to my point, to describe the rabbinic position on divorce just on the basis of the grounds of divorce is misleading. It's actually betraying a Christian agenda, because in the Christian community we debate over the grounds of divorce, when and on what basis a divorce can properly and licitly be sought. But that's not true in the Jewish community today. It was even less true in the Jewish community of the first century. In fact, the issue of the grounds for divorce constitutes only the most minute fraction of the instruction of the Mishnah on the subject of divorce. The rabbis were far more concerned about other aspects of the problem. So what was important to the rabbis? The issue of divorce is discussed at greatest length in a tractate of the Mishnah called Gittin. And it's instructive to think about the name of that tractate. There is a Hebrew word for divorce. It's kerithuth. But it's not used there. The tractate that's concerned with divorce is not called kerithuth, it's called Gittin. And the word Gittin is the Aramaic plural of a word that doesn't occur in the Hebrew Bible, but it was adopted at the end of the Second Temple period to refer to a legal document. It can be used with regard to any legal document, but because it was used so often with regard to a certificate of divorce, if it doesn't have any other qualifiers with it, we assume it's talking about a certificate of divorce. So, Tractate Gittin is about the certificate of divorce. The primary concern of the tractate is not with the divorce itself, but with the document which legalizes the divorce and with the conditions which are necessary in order to ensure that this document is authentic and valid. Let's look then at the certificate of divorce. What's necessary for a document of divorce to be valid? There's a plethora of requirements in Gittin. A valid gate, that's the singular, a valid certificate of divorce, must be written at the request of a mentally competent man with the specific purpose of divorcing a particular woman. It must be written on the proper sort of material with the proper sort of ink. It must be certified by valid witnesses whose signatures are properly placed. It must be certified on the same day it's written. It must be properly delivered to the wife in such a way that she is fully aware that she is receiving a certificate of divorce. If it is delivered by an agent from a remote place, the agent must be legally competent and must be able to testify that he saw the writing and the attestation of the document. It must clearly assert the right of the woman to remarry anyone whom she wishes to marry. Once delivered, it cannot be nullified, even if the delivery is only to an agent appointed by the woman and not to the woman herself. And even if the gate is technically improper for certain minor reasons, a woman who gets such a certificate and remarries is considered legally divorced anyway, and her subsequent children are legitimate. So too, a gate, certificate of divorce, obtained by the coercion of the husband is valid, provided the coercion was produced by Jewish court. If a man issued a gate in any dubious circumstance, he is forbidden ever to remarry the woman lest he assert that his divorce was not valid and that his wife was therefore an adulteress. Specific provisions were also made in the Mishnah for a man to divorce his wife in any circumstance where he might die without witnesses who could assure his wife's right to remarry. Provisions were also made for a husband to divorce his wife provisionally in cases where his eventual death might put his wife in difficult financial or legal circumstances. None of those views expressed in the Mishnah should be construed as indicating the rabbis favored or approved of divorce. On the contrary, many of the stipulations in Gittin had the effect of making the process of divorce slower, more cumbersome, and thus offering greater opportunity for the parties to reconcile. Some commentators have even suggested that this delaying effect was part of the intention behind certain provisions in the Mishnah. One early rabbi indicated his disapproval of divorce with a comment, "If a man divorces his first wife, even the altar sheds tears." So what's the point of all this? Rather than simply dismissing the majority of Tractate Gittin as rabbinic nitpicking, we might do ourselves a favor to ask why the rabbis, who seem as a rule to have been quite rational people, why the rabbis spent so much time and effort on these details. Why was it important for the document to be written in an ink which was indelible? Why was the position of the signatures of any significance? What difference does it make whether the agent who delivers a divorce actually saw it being written? Some of the requirements may have been motivated by a desire to be more precise in the fulfillment of the Torah, but it appears that many of them were actually motivated by a desire to protect vulnerable parties from the avoidable consequences of divorce. Since in Jewish circumstances the certificate of divorce always had to be written by the husband, and since in first century rabbinical understanding a man was permitted to have more than one wife without committing adultery, it was the woman who was most greatly imperiled by an improper divorce. If it was determined that a divorce was not really valid, she might be unable to remarry and would thus be excluded from normal society of the era. If she did remarry, she might be accused of adultery, and any children she might bear in a subsequent marriage would be regarded as mamzerim, illegitimate children, who were permanently barred from participation in the community of Israel. Thus, most of the rabbinic discussion on the subject of divorce has a compassionate purpose. It is intended to protect the vulnerable parties, the women and children. So it was imperative to assure that a divorce certificate transmitted from a husband to his wife was really valid beyond any legal challenge. What was most important in the eyes of the rabbis of the first century, especially those of Beit Hillel, was not when a divorce might take place or why a divorce might take place, but how it should be done. They understood that divorce takes place for a variety of reasons. They believed that although it was tragic, it was sometimes inevitable. They taught that if divorce occurs, it should be done in such a way as to protect those who are most likely to be harmed. Their concern was compassion. Now, with that in mind, let's come back to the New Testament. It's interesting, a moment's reflection will reveal this, that neither Jesus nor Paul, both of whom discussed divorce, neither of these talks about the procedure for divorce, which by contrast occupies nearly all of the rabbinic discussion. They have very little concern for correct procedure. They concentrate on the grounds for divorce. That familiar passage in Matthew 19 where Jesus debates with the rabbis. They ask him, is it permissible for a man to divorce his wife for any cause? And he talks to them at length about the biblical ideal of marriage. When they challenge him and say, well, Moses allowed us to put away our wives by certificate of divorce, he says, well, that was for the hardness of your heart. And then he says, of course, whoever divorces his wife except for unchastity and marries another commits adultery. Now, it's interesting that when he said that, his disciples took him off in a corner and said, if such is the case of a man with his wife, it is not expedient to marry. But he said to them, not all men can receive this saying, but only those to whom it is given. For there are eunuchs who have been so from birth, there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by men, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the kingdom of God. He who is able to receive this, let him receive it. Now, we can ask, along with a lot of commentators in the past, why were the disciples surprised? If Jesus had simply been restating what the rabbis of the time were saying, there would be no reason for the disciples to respond with shock. That's either if Jesus has said, well, you can get divorced on any grounds, or you can get divorced only on grounds of sexual impropriety and deprivation of marital rights. But obviously what Jesus was asserting appeared very strikingly unusual and unreasonable to Jesus' followers. And Jesus said nothing to suggest that their surprise was out of line. In fact, he admits, not everyone can receive this statement. There are two facets to Jesus' instruction on divorce. Jesus, on one side, his comment is surprising because of what he says. He doesn't just say that divorce is painful. He says it's immoral. On the other side, his comments are surprising because of what he doesn't say. He never attempts to clarify the procedure. He offers no suggestion to reduce the destructive consequences of this act. He's not concerned to find ways to make divorce less destructive. Instead, he appeals for divorce to be avoided altogether. And in the Jewish context, that would surprise his followers. We've gone now from Tractate Gittin back to the New Testament, to the conceptual world in which the New Testament statements were made, and I think now we can come back to our own era. In Adventism and Christianity in general, there are those two views which I mentioned at the beginning, the rigid view and the more permissive view. Those who defend the more permissive view argue that the spirit of the teachings of Christ tends to love, compassion, forgiveness, and tolerance, rather than to legalism, inflexibility, and narrow-mindedness. We can read many documents on this subject, and I will not take time to do so, but I have before me a part of the General Conference Divorce and Remarriage Study Commission document from 1999. Let me just read a small part of this. Considerations regarding remarriage. Before individuals become involved in another serious relationship, they should be encouraged to complete the above recovery process. They've described it at length. When remarriage is contemplated, the local church offers counsel. It supports their decision when it is in harmony with biblical principles. There's a lot, in fact, in this document that is commendable, but one of the things that I notice is that the major concern here is not with why divorce concerns occurs or when divorce occurs, but that document was concerned about how divorce should occur. And it recognizes that divorce occurs for a variety of reasons. It assumes that it's regrettable, that it's bad, but sometimes socially inevitable. It suggests the duty of the believing community regarding divorce is to protect the vulnerable parties from any avoidable negative consequences. I can cite another author here who talks about what the church should do. The church should be an advocate for divorced persons, not in the sense of encouraging divorce, but in the sense of providing for them the services which might minimize the damage. And the author describes what those services might be. And again, it's impossible to criticize trying to help people who are going through this serious situation. But the problem here is that the why and when of divorce are downplayed and the how is emphasized. And that is essentially the same as the view of the rabbis who composed the Mishnah, with whose views Jesus disagreed. They disliked divorce, but they recognized its social inevitability, and they tried to limit the negative consequences. And it was to people who held such a view, to first century Jews, including both the Pharisees and Jesus' disciples, that Jesus delivered a teaching which we find as difficult and surprising today as they did then. The passage of 2,000 years will not reduce the distance between the views of the Pharisees or the disciples and that of Jesus. But we must conclude that if Jesus is right, the concern for how divorce should be done, to the neglect of the question of when divorce is permissible, must be missing the mark. And if we focus on the how, because that question seems important to us, we are likely to run the risk of forgetting the question that was important to Jesus, the question of when a divorce might licitly take place.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. International Copyright 2008, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you would discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. American Christian Ministries is not a one-man band. It is an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.